Today on the Profitable Tradie podcast.
For me, taking control was taking my life. You're weak, you're skinny, you're pathetic, you're a loser, you're a burden on your family. Just keep going on and on. So I went to the balcony, the fifth floor, and I put my leg over.
So this episode will change the way you think. Now you walk away with a new perspective and the motivation to tackle even the biggest challenges.
At the start of the year, I was the fastest 800 meter runner in New Zealand. And then I was, one of the sickest. I got this diagnosis of leukemia, of cancer, 12 heart attacks in total. It's like a convulsion, it's a cramp, it's like mini seizures in my legs and hips and ribs. I had that diagnosis and apparently I was dying, but there was another pain lingering in the room, in that hospital room, and that was just looking up at my mum, seeing tears roll down her face.
Now in today's episode, I interview elite athlete and cancer survivor, Josh Coman, who has an incredible story of courage and survival. Now his story is about how he got through the worst situation, a cancer diagnosis. It's about grit, belief, hope, and rebuilding when everything has been stripped away from you.
My dream was to represent New Zealand at the Commonwealth Games in the 800 metres. That's what I wanted to do, and I thought that door had been shut. My dream was dead, and I was dying. But I've come back to life, and my dream's come back to life.
How crazy is that? That's just ridiculous.
Right? It's unreal, mate. It really is.
You're listening to the Profitable Tradie podcast, where every week we help you make more money, get your time back, and make life and business a whole lot more fun. Join us as we transform your plumbing, electrical, or similar service business into a successful operation. Don't miss a beat. Hit the follow button. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm your host, Tony Fraser-Jones, and today I've got something very special. Now, in July last year, we had a very special guest speaker at our Million Dollar Tradie member event. Now, I've never seen a speaker connect with the audience more powerfully and more meaningfully for our members. Now, and today I'm delighted to have that speaker with us, and his name is Josh Coman. Now, Josh was an elite middle distance runner who became ill with leukemia at the height of his athletic career. Now, his story is incredible. If you're facing challenges in your business or life, or you just want to live better, this episode is a must listen. So welcome, Josh. Excited to have you here with us today, mate.
Hey, thank you so much, Tony, for getting me on board, and it's great to reconnect again, man.
It is. That was an amazing a talk for our members, and it was very profound. There were tears, and when an audience is silent after a talk, you know it's really hit home. Like, it just was very moving. So today I'm really excited to actually talk to the rest of our listeners about your story. And just to kick off, I've read your book again this week. It's very moving. So I just want to put a plug in for that. If you want something that's just incredibly moving and inspiring, you've got to get a copy of this book, The Wind at My Back. It's Josh's book, and it's top stuff. So get a copy. So, I thought what we'd do today is maybe tell us about the story and, you know, your experience, because it is it's brutal, it's grueling, it's kind of gripping, and incredibly tough. And I think if we can unpack that story, and then we can look at some of the lessons that you've learned from that, because, man, there's been some, and they're very inspiring. So maybe we can kick off. Can you just tell us about the day when everything changed for you, when you were diagnosed with leukemia?
Yeah, I do remember the day quite vividly. It was in Greymouth. I'm from the coast. And prior to my diagnosis, I had two New Zealand silver medals in the 800 metres. And that year in 2011, you know, I was on the top of my game. I was actually living in Christchurch at the time. And I knew that I could potentially fulfill my dream of representing New Zealand at the Commonwealth Games. This was my year. You know, I was fit, fast, healthy and strong. But I ended up moving from Christchurch back to Greymouth because my health went downhill. And then I ended up in Greymouth Hospital thinking I had some kind of viral infection or something. But I woke up and I got this diagnosis of leukemia, of cancer. And yeah, it was a tough diagnosis to hear, because honestly, Tony, I didn't even know what leukemia was. Even the word kind of was very confusing.
Well, it's certainly difficult to spell, that's for sure.
Yeah, I always get the U and E mixed up sometimes when I spell it. But yeah, I didn't know what blood cancer was, because leukemia is a blood cancer. I had no idea. They said you got, you know, cancer in your blood. And I said, well, let's just drain my blood and put some new blood in. I said, oh, it doesn't work like that. But with the confusion there was more confusion, because I had that diagnosis and apparently I was dying, but there was another pain lingering in the room, in that hospital room, and that was just looking up at my mum, seeing tears roll down her face. And I think, to be honest, when I look back, well, I know that killed me more than the diagnosis itself. So I was in Greymouth Hospital, and they said I'd have to move back over to Christchurch for 8 months to get treatment for this cancer. And I'd have to get 8 months of treatment, and my mum would live at a place called Rā Nui House, which is a home away from home for people who live in rural sectors who need long-term treatment and care, so they can live there for free. It's an amazing place. I should stay there whilst I get the treatment.
How did you actually feel? Were you scared? Were you numb? Like, how do you actually process that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because everyone wants to know an answer around that. But honestly, it was the big capital C, and that was confusion, because it was completely unknown. I mean, my life was caught up with work. I was a line mechanic. I worked outside. I worked 10 to 12 hours a day. Then I went running. That was my life. I lived outside, basically, and I slept for about 6 to 7 hours. So the confusion factor set in, and you know, I was going to something new and novel, and I had no idea of what chemotherapy was. And when you heard the diagnosis of another C, cancer, that was a death sentence. I had, you know, friends who had cancer when they were, you know, they were in their 60s and had passed away. And I thought I was about to die, and I'm killing my mum and putting pain on her. And I asked myself, what am I doing? You know, what am I doing to my family? So for me, being that kind of tough, stoic, macho man, I shut the door on my family and my friends. And I thought, I'll start this job and I'll finish this job myself, even though I had no tools in the toolbox to really help me, you know, and probably a lot of your listeners are tradies. You can't go into the job without the proper tools. And I didn't have the proper tools, and there was going to be a lot of learning involved with what I was about to go through. So I had my first round of chemotherapy in Christchurch Hospital, and I've never experienced that amount of pain before, that physical pain. You know, I was used to some that good pain when I was out running with my heart racing, and just that short-term pain for long-term gain where you get those adaptations. But this pain just lingered and lingered and lingered. I was spewing up and myself, and nurses were doing so much for me. And as I said, I couldn't talk to anybody because I didn't know how to talk. And I was locked up in an isolation room for 1 month at a time. Then I'd have a week to 2 weeks out to get ready and then back in again. And being in isolation was completely new to me. And yep. That mental pain that I spoke about earlier, Tony, just kept building up and building up. It was like, and then it just exploded one day. I was out at Rā Nui House for 2 weeks, and I was on a fifth floor, and this was 3 months into my treatment. I got all this physical pain. I turned into a really skinny little alien. I couldn't really associate myself with that strong physical person anymore. And I thought, that's enough. You know, I wanted to take control. For me, taking control was taking my life. You know, this is the way I could end these extreme negative, vile thoughts that were kind of ramping through my mind. You're weak, you're skinny, you're pathetic, you're a loser, you're a burden on your family. Just keep going on and on. So I went to the balcony, the fifth floor, and I put my leg over. And it always gets you, no matter how many times you talk about it, because, I'm sitting here talking to you and the memory comes back and you think, what were you thinking? But I put my foot over. And in that moment, it's like this big gust of wind hit the right-hand side of my face, and I turned around and I saw my mum's cup of tea there, and I pulled back, and I felt this, you know, immense sense of love, and I couldn't put the pain I was feeling inside my mum. So my mum's cup of tea, her love, pulled me back, and I sat down and just cried hysterically, Tony. Still remember it, piercing my fingernails through my bald head, still bald head. Through my head and just crying, man. I just, what the heck is going on? You know, I've got this cancer and these negative thoughts, and I couldn't control it, so I needed some help. And luckily in New Zealand we have amazing charities such as the Blood and Leukemia Foundation, Cancer Society, and I was still under 23 at that time, so the Canteen Foundation. And I rung up the canteen coordinator. I said, can I have one of those psychologists that you were recommending at the start that I always turned away?
Yeah, that you didn't need.
That I didn't need, yeah, because I'm a man, I can do it myself. So she said, yep, absolutely. And I finally got to speak to somebody and talk to somebody about how I was feeling and what was going on. Honestly, Tony, the psychologist didn't give me any answers. They just listened. And that was the best part about it. I just got all my thoughts out and managed to talk to someone in a safe place. And yeah, it really, really helped a lot. So that was the first 3 to 4 months of my diagnosis. I still have 4 months to go.
We'll talk about the rest of the treatment in a moment, because, I mean, it's grueling. It's like nothing that any of us who haven't been through it can really understand. But who was Josh Coman before any of this, you know, before the diagnosis, the backstory, the growing up, the athletics, the all that?
He was a bit of a cheeky character. He loved to laugh.
Can't imagine that. He's still a cheeky bugger.
He loved to laugh. He but he loved sport. He loved running, loved nature, loved being outside. You know, I love being up in the hills and just, you know, out in the water, fishing, doing a little bit of hunting and things like that. I was just physically built for outside and loved to laugh with my mates. My granddad had a farm. I was down on the farm a lot. And outside, nature was my home. So for me, I was a fit, fast, healthy person. I was the guy who would go out and get firewood, you know, bring it around to my family, you know, help everyone around my community. Yeah, I enjoyed just physically doing things, if that makes sense. I mean, that's who I was. I was
and you were fast.
And I was fast. Yeah, I was. I won numerous Canterbury titles from the 5K to the 1500 and 800 meters, 400 meters too. I got a Canterbury title in the 400 meters and I had two silver medals at New Zealand Champs, at one at the age of 20. And that's when I thought I could really do something with my running. And, you know, I was really driven, really determined, really focused. And I moved to Christchurch and I surrounded myself with good people, as you do when you want to get the best out of yourself. You put yourself around good people. And we had a really good running community here in Christchurch. And things were going great. I mean, I was training twice a day, had a good job. And I knew that with more training, more dedication, I would fulfill my childhood dream of representing New Zealand, you know, the country that I loved, whether it be the Commonwealth Games, the Olympics, or Oceania Champs. That's where I was going to go, and that's what I wanted to do. So, unfortunately, sometimes in life things do change, don't they? And
they do.
You know, I wasn't prepared for that change, and it was totally unexpected. And I, as I said earlier, I didn't have the tools to negotiate that, but I did have the tools for running. But running and cancer don't really coincide together. The only fact is my running gave me a good aerobic capacity to endure the treatment. Yeah, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah, and family was important as well.
My family was pivotal. I mean, I have an amazing mama. She's an absolute angel. She really is. I mean, I've got a fantastic dad, but our relationship wasn't the best as I was growing up. He had a really dysfunctional childhood and I didn't understand him. He wasn't into sport and I was a sportsman. We didn't really understand one another. We didn't really communicate too much. My dad was a hard, hard worker. He worked at the coal mine and, you know, I barely saw my dad. So that was one good thing that happened from my diagnosis. I actually saw my dad cry for the first time in my life. And him crying and seeing those tears roll down his face, I thought my dad was the toughest man in the world. And it really showed the love that he had for me, that he did love me. I know he did, but he hadn't expressed it like that before.
Yeah.
And, you know, we hugged, we talked, we spoke, and he told me a bit about himself, his self. So that connection piece really connected me to dad. But I have a sister and a brother. Amazing family. I really do. Yeah.
So we were talking about the treatment for, spoiler alert, leukemia part one, because there's more to the story. Like it's a story that stacks on itself. So we're partway through that treatment. Can you talk us through the back half of that treatment and where that ended up?
So we had 4 months to go. So I spoke with my psychologist, you know, basically he just told me, Josh, it's not you that wants to die. It's just the pain in the situation. I had to separate the two and he gave me a few tools and I opened myself up to talk to people, you know, bring some people in that you trust. So doing that and then I was journaling a lot, writing, and I was going back to my running visualization practices, seeing myself strong, healthy and full of meaning. And I was getting better. I was mentally getting better. And I had 4 more months. Got out, but he also gave me that book, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which completely changed my life. I highly recommend that to anybody. It was in the 20th century. It's the most top 10 influential book that a book's been written in the 20th century. So Viktor Frankl suffered in Auschwitz and Dachau and 2 other prisoner of war camps and still found positive meaning in his life, Man's Search for Meaning. It just changed my whole life. It really did. If he could go through his atrocities, surely I could go through mine. So it gave me a positive perspective in a way. I got out of hospital, so that was 8 months of treatment, went back to the coast and I just went back out into nature where I felt comfortable. I was a bit confused still. You know, at the start of the year, I was the fastest runner, 800 meter runner in New Zealand. And then I was, you know, one of the sickest, and I wanted to take my life. So I spoke to some people in my community who I trust, and I just went surfing, sat out and surf. And, you know, I just sat there and prayed and I meditated and I just, you know, asked questions about what happened in a peaceful way, not in a negative way, but in a peaceful way. I just asked questions, and I got a phone call from a friend. He said, "Do you want to come to Everest Base Camp?" And I said no. I went back out in the surf, and I knew that there was a high chance that my cancer could come back, and I was scared. And sometimes we had to break down that fear barrier, because previously to my cancer, I was so focused on my running, I turned down opportunities beforehand. So for me, I had to take this opportunity, even though I was so scared. And I rang him back up. I said, "Yeah, let's go to Kathmandu. Let's go to Nepal." So 5 months after my last round of treatment, I was off to Kathmandu, which was absolutely life-changing for me as well. I flew into Kathmandu, and it was sensory overload. It really was. There was incredible people there. And this was a really transformative moment for me, Tony. I still remember it. I got on my tuk-tuk, and I'm driving to the backpackers, and I see these kids, these beautiful kids, and some were naked, and some had their pants on and that, and they were playing in rubbish in this muddy puddle. And they looked up at me with these beautiful smiles and waved, and I thought, far out. These kids have absolutely nothing, but they're making the best of what they have. And here I was, 8 months of treatment. I had everything I needed to suffer in good conditions, hospital bed, my mum, good food, adequate treatment, and these kids had nothing, but yet they were making the best of what they had in front of them. You know, and even today, like when I'm a bit down, a bit low, I always have this image in my head of these kids playing in rubbish who have nothing, but still smiling and being grateful for what they have. So that just changed my whole perspective, and my smile just got bigger, if that makes sense. Met up with my mate, and we managed to go to Everest, Mount Everest Base Camp. It took us 12 to 13 days to get there. It was a very tough challenge, but an absolute meaningful moment for me. You know, when you break down that fear barrier, you know, and you're there with your friend and your patient, and you keep persevering. You know, you get these moments that are bookmark moments that no one can take away in those tough situations. So yeah, that was a huge moment for me. Got back down from base camp, become a professional skydiver.
Don't do things by halves, buddy.
Well, you've got to make the most of life, Tony. And you know, I had an opportunity to live my life again, and I wanted to make the most of that. So I asked myself two or three things that I wanted to do in my life. And one was to go to Everest Base Camp, and two was to become a professional skydiver, and three was to run again. I managed two of those things, to become a skydiver. And I was halfway through my course of skydiving course, and I got diagnosed with leukemia again.
So it came back. Can you talk us through when you realized things weren't right?
Yeah, I didn't want to accept that it was right, but my body was kind of fatiguing a bit. I kind of thought, oh no, wasn't too sure. But anyways, I went to a jump. It was 18,000 feet, quite high. So I jumped out with my mate, and I got hypoxic, which means I had low oxygen saturation, which meant I had low red blood cell count. Oxygen binds to red blood cells. And I saw one, then two, then three, then about 10 of them severely hypoxic. And I thought, geez. So I pulled my parachute, spiraled to the ground, and I just lay on the ground, and I looked up at my hand because I had my lines there, and I saw purple dots on my hand, which meant low platelets. Platelets are clotting factors in our blood. It was the same thing that kind of occurred the first time I was diagnosed. So I knew my cancer had come back. So I just waited a week for my annual follow-up with my doctor. And then sure enough, he gave me the diagnosis. My leukemia was back. And this time the treatment was going to be a lot more aggressive. It was going to be very severe.
And I imagine you couldn't even comprehend how it could be more aggressive given what you'd been through the first time. That must have been a pretty frightening moment.
Frightening, no. It really wasn't frightening. It was just the fact that I didn't understand how physically tough this treatment was going to be. See, I thought I was prepared this time because I've already been through chemotherapy, but what I'd have to have this time, Tony, was a thing called an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Now, just for the listeners, just so they can get an understanding, my immune system would have to be replaced. Now, you think, how does that happen? Our immune system is derived from these small cells called hematopoietic stem cells in our bone marrow, and they make our red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets and things like that. So what would have to happen is I'd have to have this high toxic chemotherapy combined with high toxic radiation. It would annihilate my whole immune system, basically like the Christchurch earthquakes, and I like the city and would have to rebuild it. So they'd have to rebuild my whole new immune system, and these stem cells would have to come from somebody else. So that's the process, the treatment that I'd have to have. And it's kind of the worst of the worst in terms of physicality. And there's a byproduct from it as well. I mean, if you have this immune system come from somebody else, your new immune system can see your tissue, your whole body is foreign, and start to attack it. So one, you could have this treatment that starts to save your life, but then it could kill you too. So yeah, it's like an oxymoron there.
Can you give us a bit of an insight into how tough that time was? Because this is not like a 2-week treatment or you go and have an operation. This is years of, and it's still a challenge in many ways now for you with you know, some of the stuff you deal with. Can you just give us a window into that so people can understand how challenging this is?
Cancer had come back. I went in, I had 2 months of chemotherapy, and during that time I got neutropenic sepsis. That means I had no neutrophils, no immune system. So I got put into the intensive care unit where I was in a coma for 10 days. And basically they told my parents I potentially couldn't wake up. My parents had to come in and basically say goodbye. God willing, I did wake up after 10 days. Now, the normal protocol for a transplant is you have 2 months of normal treatment that I had, and then you have 2 months off to get the body right for the transplant, for the treatment around that, because it's so toxic and the treatment itself can kill you. So waking up from that coma, I only had 2 weeks to kind of get myself ready. I couldn't walk and I couldn't talk, and I was writing things on a little whiteboard, and I was getting pushed around in a wheelchair. So physically, I had just deteriorated. And I don't think that's ever happened before, where someone's come out of a coma and had to have this transplant. So then I got lined up to have this full body irradiation with high toxic chemotherapy that would annihilate my immune system, to allow this immune system, these stem cells from Germany, from a young girl. They got donated from a city called Dresden in Germany. They had 92 hours to get to me to repopulate my new immune system. Now, from that, you get graft versus host disease, which was an anti-rejection, saw my body as foreign, and it just went rampant. It really started to kill me. It affected my eyes, my skin, my tissue, my stomach, my mouth, and it was killing me from the inside out. It was saying, hey, this is not my body. I don't live here. I want to destroy it. And I had basically a year of complications, Tony, a year of complications. I was in and out of hospital. The first 3 months, I was in an isolation room for 3 months solid on a machine, just keeping me stable. I had everything to kind of keep me alive. I couldn't eat, but I spoke about moments of meaning before, like going to Everest Base Camp. That was a big moment of meaning, but sometimes there can be small things in our life that we just take for granted. And that was my mum coming over with some sparkling water and putting a straw in my mouth and feeling the bubbles in my mouth. You know, it's just so refreshing and so joyful. And then I'd spit the water out because I couldn't swallow it, wasn't allowed to swallow it, but that little moment of what my mum gave me in her hand to hold just sustained me through that period of time, because it was a very, very tough time. I mean, a year of complications. It was just, yeah, very tough.
And there are times where you're in so much pain, you definitely didn't want to be here anymore.
Yeah, that was about to come, that pain. I mean, I got myself right. I got just over, it was about 12, 13 months in hospital, in and out. Then I was allowed out. Went back to Greymouth, went to Nelson, tried to get myself right. Then I got a letter from my donor, an email, which was unheard of. What I wrote a thank you letter to her. It was a postcard of Greymouth of the West Coast, sent it to her. And what she'd done is track down all the skydiving centres in New Zealand and asking, is there a person who's had a transplant? And obviously, I was the only one. So the receptionist at Skydive Motueka, who I was friends with, sent me an email saying, hey, I think we've got your donor here. So I was emailing with her. So I was a little bit healthy now, a little bit healthy. It wasn't really good, but I wanted to go and say thank you, Tony. You know, when people have helped you out or saved your life, you have to go and say thanks. So I flew over to Germany, to Berlin, but I physically wasn't ready for the cold. And I met her, gave her a hug, and it was just phenomenal. You know, no words of thank you could really express my gratitude towards what she had done. But we've become good friends now. And yeah, I said thanks, but the Berlin cold, it was minus 20, some days minus 10, and I got put into Berlin hospital with pneumonia, and that GVHD had kind of flared up, got flown back. And yeah, this pain that you spoke about before is called trigeminal neuralgia. So from that pneumonia, from the GVHD, I got this thing called trigeminal neuralgia. It's also described as the worst pain known to man, hence the reason it's called the suicide disease, because 20% of people who get this take their life. So to describe the pain, I kind of describe it like it's like a cheese grater behind your eye while someone was stabbing you while my face was on fire. And the pain was just horrendous, Tony. It really was. And I was in the hospital for 3 months, just screaming, you know, asking the doctors to kill me. I was on all the pain medication you can think of. They rang up the UK and they put me on a pain protocol. They sent me back into the intensive care unit to kind of alleviate this pain through this protocol. They give me high doses of this. It's an anesthetic called lignocaine, and try and numb the nerve. And thank goodness it did. It numbed it to a certain degree, but there was still a bit of residual pain behind me. But it was nothing to compare to what it was. And I had bursts and bursts of this pain. But the GVHD, that graft versus host disease I spoke about, it doesn't leave me, because my donor was a girl. She was a mismatch. It's always going to see my immune system is always going to see my tissue as foreign, and it just flared up from being in that acute inflammatory response. It just flared up and my body kind of was starting to glue itself together. So I became like a rusty wheel. If people can visualize a rusty wheel, you know, just I could barely bend over and tie my shoes. I had to get lifted out of bed. And the treatment of immunosuppressants and steroids weren't doing its job. So I'd have to get sent to Melbourne to get this special treatment. And they said you'd be over there for about 6 months. The treatment was going quite well. I was getting a little bit better. However, I woke up one morning and I had a heart attack, another heart attack.
Of course.
And then I had 12 heart attacks in total, got sent to Melbourne Hospital in the cardiac unit. And I was there for 24 days, having multiple heart attacks, 12 in total. And my GVHD had flared up again. And so I was meant to be there for 6 months. I ended up being in Melbourne for five years. And yeah, I felt severely depressed again. And what the heck's going on? I wanted to take my life quite often. I had those thoughts, but my mum's love and the promise that I made that I wouldn't take my life was always there. And then, yeah, it was just an incredibly tough time. It really was, Tony. However, I started to get myself right a bit. I found this place called Fifth Element Wellness. It was a wellness center. And I found this thing called an ice bath, and I jumped in the ice bath and I just felt great. I've never felt so good. I mean, I felt good before my diagnosis, but just it alleviated so much pain that I was carrying, and it just gave me a bit of clarity when I got out. And I felt a bit more confident within myself that I could get through my treatment and get myself back together again. It just gave me that bit of hope and encouragement. And whilst I was feeling a bit better, I was allowed to start flying back and forth to Melbourne. About 3 years into the treatment, I was flying back and forth, and on one flight from Christchurch to Melbourne, the whole plane was full, and I sat next to this young girl. She was from Switzerland, and I was feeling a bit better within myself and engaging with people. And, you know, this was about 6-7 years from my first diagnosis now. And I saw her, and you know, I just said hello. Said hello, and she said hello back, and we got conversing and had a conversation. And then I asked her, you know, what do you do for a job in Switzerland? What's your work? And she said, oh, I'm a cancer nurse, an oncology nurse. I work with cancer people. And she kind of knew I had cancer by looking at me. My face had been a bit disfigured and pigmentated and that. And I said, she asked me what I was doing. And I said, oh, I'm actually going over for the special cancer treatment. I told her what it's called, ECP, extracorporeal photopheresis. And she said, I've never heard of that. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll use this as a pickup line or...
Smart man. Love it.
And then I just asked her, I said, listen, do you want to come and see it? Do you want to come and see the treatment? And she said, yes. And I honestly thought she was just being nice and polite. You know, she's doing a backpacking thing. Why would she want to come and see cancer treatment while she's on holiday? But I said, oh, well, if you are keen, meet me at Parliament Building on top of Burke Street at 10 a.m. and we'll go to Peter McCullum Cancer Centre and we can see it together. And sure enough, she was there. She was true to her word, Tony, and she backed up what she said, which was a key value of mine. And lo and behold, she went to Peter McCullum today. It's still the first time it's ever been delayed. I don't know if that was a setup or not, but it was. It was supposed to be at 10:30. It was delayed to 1 p.m. She spent the morning with me. We had a coffee and we had a lot in common. She came back and watched the 4-hour treatment and we spent the week together. And yeah, she saw me from the inside out instead of the outside in, and we fell in love. And yeah, 3 years ago, we got married, mate. So Yeah, she changed my life, Tony.
And there's more to that story as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there's more to the story. It's the best part of the story. I mean, meeting Sybil, just, yeah, I mean, sorry, mate.
You have a daughter as well.
Yeah, we have a daughter too, Tony. She's an absolute miracle. She really is. I mean, I met Sybil and I thought that was awesome. That's enough. I got told that I potentially couldn't have kids when I was first diagnosed due to the cancer and things like that. And Maya was an IVF baby, and to be fair, mate, it was the easiest medical procedure I've ever been a part
of.
But yeah, little Maya, our little girl, she's 2.5 now, and what a blessing she is. You know, I talk about at the start, you know, I was about to take my life, and mate, I wanted to take my life so many times, Tony. Yeah. I really did, especially in Melbourne. That was one of the toughest times I've ever been through. But here I was, you know, wanting to take my life. Now I have the ability to give life and give back life into the world. And man, does she radiate life. We were speaking about kids earlier, and the smiles and the joy that she puts in our life. I mean, it's just profound. So to have what I have in my life and going through what I went through, this is 14 years ago now.
Yeah.
I still have issues and stuff, but to live the life and have what I have when I could have shut that all down, I'm truly, truly blessed and so grateful for. I really am, Tony. And I couldn't even fathom it, mate. I really couldn't. I couldn't even picture it in my mind to have what I have.
Yeah.
No doubt I have my days, for sure. I'm not perfect or anything like that. Physically, I really struggle. I mentioned about my body gluing itself together. Yeah. So my body in the evening will kind of, it's like a convulsion. It's a cramp. It's like mini seizures in my legs and hips and ribs and arms, and it'll lock up and push back on me. I have issues with my eyes. Last year, I lost vision in my right-hand side of my eye, so I had to have a bit of placenta put into my eye to rejuvenate it, to heal it. My mouth's always dry. I have to keep drinking water. Yeah, so I definitely physically struggle. I have to manage my energy levels. But as I said, you know, I'm so grateful for what I have. I have an amazing life in terms of who I have in it and what I can do, like those kids in the pool. You know, I'm trying to make the most of what I have in front of me. And I do have a lot in front of me. It's just opening up my eyes to see it, and I can see it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so excited for us to chat today, because we've been talking about life in general. And obviously we're working with contractors and tradespeople, and they're in Canada, they're in the US, they're in Australia, they're in New Zealand, they're all over, but the challenges are very similar. And some of them are really struggling with where they're at. And, they might think, hey, it's not a cancer diagnosis, but it's their life and it's their real challenges, and they're really real for people. Mm. And so I think this is very powerful for people to see, some of the lessons that you've learned as well. So I would love for us to dig into that. What do you see as the lessons from this incredible journey that you think would help our listeners not only have a better business, but just live better?
It's a really good question. It really is, because we always want the magic bullet, one answer, and one answer doesn't fit for everybody. But the biggest thing that I've learned, Tony, the biggest thing that I've learned through my journey is patience. Good things come to those who wait. For me, patience is something that I learned, and this has been 14 years going through the hellstorm that I went through. And sometimes we just want to give up. But if we're patient, we're persistent, and we persevere, I truly believe that good things come, that the doors will open. And it's just not my story that narrates that. There's so many other stories that we buy into. That's why we watch movies, you know, to see the good guy overcome the evil in the end. I mean, but it takes time. And in that acute phase of chaos, we just want to pull our hands up and just pull back and just put our head under the cover or dig ourselves a hole. But if we just keep poking ourselves out of that hole and just be patient, and soon we can get out and we can see light. And I know it's a cliche. I understand that, but it's the truth. It really is the truth. If we're patient, if we're persistent and just keep chipping away at the small things and we persevere, things can change significantly for you. And my story is just an analogy for everybody else's story. That's all it is, whether it's cancer, whether it's a medical issue, whether it's you're breaking up with your spouse or or your business is hemorrhaging money or whatever it may be, things can change if you're patient, if you weather the storm and go through it. And honestly, that's the biggest thing that I've learned. And yeah, I mean, that's the only thing I can give to the audience that's listening. I mean, there's a whole heap of other things that we can do for ourselves in that acute phase, but an overall factor is being patient. Just wait it out.
So be patient, persist, and persevere.
For me, what were the things that I could do? You know, I'd wake up in the morning, even though I was sore, I'd get on one foot and just start balancing. So that's trying to activate the mind-body connection. Doing little things like that, I'd just go for a small walk, whether it's 10 meters, 20 meters, or 30 meters. There was something that I could still do for myself. And that's being persistent. What are the things that we can do? What is it in our business that I can still do, even though I don't have the money that I used to have? Be persistent with that. Things will still change. Turn up for that meeting, have a connection with that person. I look at health in itself. Connection for me is the foundation of health. So if we're patient, we turn up and talk to the individuals that are going through different issues, or maybe people who are going through good things, maybe we can glean some advice from them. Reach out, speak to somebody, talk to somebody. Don't put your head under the blanket.
Yeah, I think that's very powerful. It's denial is and hiding will not change things. And controlling what you can control is very powerful. And I think it's what we talk about a lot with our members when you're in a difficult situation is there's always something you can do to improve your situation. And if there's not something, you can change the way you look at your situation, which I think is what Viktor Frankl is about to a large extent. You can actually choose the way you respond to something, which is not easy, but it is a better approach than just raging against the machine, because when you're in that state, you cannot do, nothing really good comes from that. And so I think what you're saying about control what you can control and keep doing that, and what we find in the long term when you do that, things actually do start to change, which is pretty cool.
Absolutely. I mean, we get ourselves into an acute stressed phase, for example. Maybe things aren't going well in a job. I mean, I call it creating space. It's just stepping back, just taking a few conscious breaths so we think a bit more rationally. And Viktor Frankl says, when everything seems to be taken away, we still have our attitude to choose. We still have that choice, no matter what's been happening in our life. So that's our conscious choice to choose our attitude. And I have a little acronym for myself, which is breathe, just take a few breaths. That creates awareness. Once we have that awareness, we can choose our attitude, you know, because it's never as bad as what we perceive it to be. And not even my situation. I had the narrow aperture of trying to take my life, but thank goodness I didn't. And if I did, I wouldn't be here today talking to you and having this great conversation. So that's the awareness and attitude. And then I assign a meaning to what I'm doing. And we always have meaning in life. I mean, the meaning of my life right now is having a conversation with you and connecting with other people. So the meaning within it is finding it for yourself, that ability to search for the meaning. So, I mean, that's what we can do in an acute phase of stress is breathe, which helps us find awareness. We can choose our attitude. Even though things might not be going right, we still have that conscious choice to choose our attitude and find meaning in what we're doing.
So, Josh, what do you think it is that separates the people who break down from those who actually break through?
I think it's being curious, Tony. Having the awareness to grow. I mean, I could either see my cancer as an opportunity or a tragedy. And for sure, I did see it as a tragedy at the start, but I loved to understand what was going on, and I dug deep into the research of leukemia and understand and become quite curious about it. So whether it's a negative situation, there's always an opportunity to growth and learn. And I think that learning aspect and understanding the situation, I think Marie Curie said it. She was a Nobel Prize winner, first female to win a Nobel Prize. She said, nothing in life is to be feared. It's only to be understood. Now's the time to fear less, to understand more. So that understanding, that curiosity aspect, I think is a huge part for people who can break through, trying to understand and learn from the situation, having that growth mindset around themselves. Also too, the ability to reach out and ask for help and connect with individuals. And for me, which was really pivotal, and we haven't really spoken about that, was finding a faith. And that faith factor, even though I was alone sometimes physically, spiritually, I always had someone with me guiding me through my dark times. And it's shown in the literature too with resilience. The people who have a faith seem to be more resilient than the people who don't. So they are the three things that I can really correlate to going through hard times and breaking through those barriers is one, being curious, two, connecting with individuals, and three, finding a faith that's unique to you.
So I'm struck by your faith. Can you talk us through how important that is for you and for your challenge in your life?
It's one of the most important things for me, Tony. It's my foundation. It really is. I mean, I didn't have much of a faith or if that before my diagnosis, but if we roll back to when I was first diagnosed, after my counselling sessions, I went back into the hospital, and every hospital room has a Bible in it, and I read Viktor Frankl's book, and he spoke about God and faith and things like that. And I just opened up the Bible to my name, which was Joshua, and then I read a verse. It was Joshua 1, verse 9, "Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, do not or dismayed, for the Lord God is with you." And it just spoke to me. And from then on in, I always started to pray, and that prayer kind of created that space for me to be able to connect with something bigger than myself. I mean, I knew that I was a small part of a big part of the universe, and that just made me feel very special and unique, that I had something to offer. And even though I was alone in Melbourne, especially when I was in Melbourne by myself, when I had all these negative thoughts blasting through my mind, I still had my faith there, and I still felt that I had someone with me, even though I was alone. And it just helped me go drive myself forward and get myself out of bed. It just gave me that motivation to say, hey, I'm here, I'm with you, keep going. Be patient, be persistent, persevere. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. And that faith, the hope that it would get better, just resonated within my heart. I think it was the biggest thing that really sustained me through that tragically turmoil time that I was going through.
Yeah, and hope is so powerful for anyone in any situation. And I think sometimes when you lose hope, and you can do that with your business or your relationships or whatever, it's a dark place because there's nothing to live for then.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a dark place, but it's not so dark if we have a connection piece there, because we need to be connected. We're creatures of connection. Whether everyone's gone through something difficult in their life, Tony, whether it's cancer or something completely different, everyone's going through something. And we often think it's only me, just me. But if we reach out, search for those connections, have a conversation, maybe you want to find the faith or dig deeper within yourself. Whatever you choose to do, remember, as Viktor Frankl said, we can choose our attitude. That's your choice to reach out and ask for help and find hope within where you are right now.
It's good stuff, man. Your faith journey has always certainly been inspiring for me, and I know a lot of other people as well. What I'd love to do is to, before we finish, is to talk about the exciting adventure that you're preparing for now, because this is pretty cool.
Yeah, I have to just thank Profitable Tradies for helping me in this department too. I mean, it's a big thing. I mean, my life's changed dramatically. I spoke at the start, you know, my dream was to represent New Zealand at the Commonwealth Games in the 800 metres. That's what I wanted to do. And I thought that door had been shut. My dream was dead and I was dying. But I've come back to life and my dreams come back to life, if that makes sense. And I've got the opportunity to represent New Zealand in the 800 metres at a thing called the World Transplant Games. And it's pretty special because where it's been hosted this year in August is in Dresden, where my stem cells were collected from in Germany too. So
how crazy is that? That's just ridiculous, right?
It's unreal, mate. It really is. So my donor's going to be there. She's going to hold my hand and we're going to walk out together in the opening ceremony. And it's so meaningful, Tony. It's this full circle moment happening. And I get to close the door on it and the door's been opened in a completely different light. So that's why I talk about when everything seems to be taken away, it's going to come back in a completely different light. And I wholeheartedly believe in that. If you're patient, you're persistent, you persevere, doors open that you do not see. And, you know, the dream was dying. The dream was dead of representing New Zealand in the 800 metres. But it's come back to represent New Zealand in a more meaningful way at the Transplant Games in the city where my life was saved, you know. I've got no words for it sometimes. I'm speechless because it's so special. And whether it's the Transplant Games for me or something for you, whatever it may be, will be there at the end if you're patient. If you're just patient and just keep choosing to wake up for another day, and my life's just got better and better and better and so meaningful. So yeah, I've been training for this Transplant Games, and it's it's tough, it's very difficult, but the meaning behind it drives me forward.
Yeah. Josh, this has been a great episode, and I appreciate your candor, sharing, you know, your life and your lessons and the low points and the high points. And you have a real gift for inspiring people. And I know that you you do speak at events and stuff. So if someone is looking for an amazing story, you must get in touch with Josh. It's he goes into even more detail when he talks to you as well. So I really appreciate you, brother. I love your work, and just wish you all the best for the Transplant Games and life in general, man. There's more good stuff coming.
Hey, thank you so much, Tony. And I'm really blessed to be able to connect with you, and thank you for the support Profitable Tradies have given me and what you give to other tradies as well. So thank you so much for your kind-hearted support, Tony. I really appreciate you, mate.
Not at all. You're a good man.
Thank you, brother.
Next week on the Profitable Tradie Podcast. Ever look at your bank account after a big week of jobs and think there should be some good profits coming, but when the end of the month rolls around, you're left wondering what happened to all the money? Now tune into this episode where we dig into why it's not how many jobs you do or what you charge for them that counts. It's what happens inside each job that makes the difference. Because if you're not tracking the performance of each individual job in detail, you'll be bleeding cash. Congratulations on being part of a select group of savvy business owners who are taking their businesses to the next level. And to help you on your journey, don't forget to check out our show notes for a copy of our free book, The Profitable Tradie, and other valuable resources. Thanks for being a part of this special group, and we'll see you in the next episode of the Profitable Tradie Podcast.